This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Tony is not here today. I'm Peter Sprigg, Senior Fellow for Policy Studies at Family Research Council.
And I'm Chris Gasek, Senior Fellow for Regulatory Policy.
And we're filling in for Tony this Friday. We'll be talking about a lot of post-election news today. A couple of segments talking about the Trump transition process, and one talking, however, about one of the key state races in the country, which is still undecided right now. As of today, we still don't know who won the North Carolina governor's race between the incumbent governor, Pat McCrory, Republican, and the Attorney General Roy Cooper, the Democrat. The last tally that I found on the web, at a particular website I looked at, had Cooper ahead of McCrory by less than 4,500 votes out of over 5.5 million cast. So that's less than 0.1%, 0.1% of the vote. And the McCrory campaign has filed complaints in a number of counties across the state with allegations of voter fraud and voting irregularities, over 50 counties, right, more than half of the state's counties. So here to talk with us about the situation in North Carolina is John Rustin, president of the North Carolina Family Policy Council. John, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, thanks, Peter and Chris. It's great to be with you today.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. And what's your take on the situation on the ground there? It seems like there is considerable evidence of voter fraud. I know in at least one county there's the allegation is that there was a large block of absentee ballots that appeared to be filled out all by the same person with the same handwriting and so forth. Can you fill us in a little bit more on some of the details of what's going on there?
Well, sure. The local or county boards of elections are in the process of doing canvassing, looking and counting votes and doing random searches to legitimize the votes in multiple counties across the state. Of course, North Carolina has 100 counties, and as you mentioned, there have been challenges or questions raised in at least 50 or more than 50 counties across the state with respect to allegations of irregularities with the vote and the counting of votes from this election. The count actually right now, as of the last numbers that I have seen, Peter, have Roy Cooper, the Democrat, leading incumbent Republican Pat McCrory with 6,600 votes.
Okay.
And so as these counties are now reporting in after completing their canvassing, and to my count, as of the most recent numbers that I looked at, which was within the last 30 minutes, about 38 counties have canvassed and reported those final numbers into the State Board of Elections, which means there's 62 counties yet to report in. And as those counties have reported in, the margin that Cooper has over McCrory has actually extended somewhat. But some of the larger counties have yet to report. And so, and in some of those counties, there again are allegations that, as you said, there were individuals that helped others fill out absentee ballots and submitted those ballots all in the same handwriting, which has raised some questions. There have been questions about individuals who are deceased actually having cast ballots and things of that nature. So, a lot of checking and rechecking of these ballots will certainly take place, and it may actually be weeks before we know what the final outcome of this race is going to be.
It's an interesting phenomenon that the dead always vote Democrat. It's funny how you can be a Republican when you're alive, and then you just have a change of something. I guess it's not heart. I don't know what, but anyway. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt with such an irreverent comment there.
Right. Well, and we want to mention FRC has a special interest in North Carolina, right? Because our friends at FRC Action spent a good deal of time down there with our values bus tour.
They went to all those 100 counties.
They went to all 100 counties in North Carolina and recognized this as a battleground state, not only in the presidential election, which it was and was carried by Donald Trump, but also in this election with Governor McCrory, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, and Attorney General candidate State Senator Buck Newton were all on the ballot. Now, of course, the big controversy in North Carolina has been the passage earlier this year of House Bill 2 dealing with the transgender issue and the transgender bathrooms. Do you think, John, that issue hurt Governor McCrory? Were the Democrats able to use that against him effectively, or were there other issues that were crucial in this race as well?
Well, I think there were a lot of issues that were crucial in this race. I think that the Democrats and certainly the media, the state and national media, attempted to bludgeon Governor McCrory with their misguided perceptions of House Bill 2 and a lot of the falsities that they were spreading about that bill. But as we talked to pastors, to churches, to concerned citizens, to Christian voters all across the state, as you all did, and it was great to partnership with work in partnership with FRC, and the Values Bus, we participated in many of those stops around the state and appreciate very much that opportunity and all of that you all did here. But as we talk with voters across the state, and particularly conservative, pro-family Christian voters in North Carolina, House Bill 2, the bathroom privacy and safety issue, was absolutely a motivating factor, but something that really drove people out to vote for McCrory. His championing position in that bill, and also Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, who was really the elected official in the state who was most out front in defense of that real common sense piece of legislation, he won his race by over 300,000 votes. And so I am convinced that that the passage of House Bill 2, the passage of a statewide policy that established safety and privacy for women and children in North Carolina in bathrooms, showers, and locker rooms across the state really came to the aid of Governor McCrory and brought out a tremendous amount of the base that, frankly, otherwise, if the governor and the General Assembly had retreated from that common sense legislation, it would have, I think, caused a lot of folks to stay home that otherwise came out and voted in order to show their support for the governor and for this very important common sense privacy and safety legislation.
I just have a couple of quick questions, because as I was watching North Carolina, I've spent a lot of time in Western North Carolina, and I'm actually a member of the North Carolina Bar. I just love the state, and it's one of my favorite. I'm a Carolina Tar Heels fan, and all it's just a lot of things, and I just was really surprised that the election turned out it did, especially after the whole big thing in Charlotte and the massive floods and after the hurricane. It seemed like Governor McCrory had done well in both of those big, very public events. And I was just wondering did they have any effect? Like, did Mecklenburg County have any sort of a different pattern than typical? Or I'm just curious, because you understand the state, so.
Well, there were a variety of issues. There was a transportation issue, a toll road issue in Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, that had a significant play in the elections in that area, and certainly in other areas of the state. There were other local issues that came into play. But by and large, a lot of what took place in North Carolina over the past months was completely consumed by House Bill 2. And really the bludgeoning that the state and national media tried to put on the governor because of that bill. And he really became the whipping boy, so to speak, for interests that were opposed to that legislation. And I really think it's remarkable that the governor performed as well as he did, considering the onslaught that the media and the groups like the Human Rights Campaign, the ACLU, and others on the far left you know, the money and all the efforts that they poured into the state to try to defeat him, for him to remain as competitive as he has in that political sense, I think is really remarkable and really shows that there are a lot of people in the state who are incredibly supportive of him for the stand that he took, the defense that he gave for that legislation. So, you know, I think there are a lot of different issues. Of course, the Trump Clinton factor played significantly into that, into the election as well. I think that, again, from the standpoint of our constituent base, that the governor's role in the defense of House Bill 2 really played to his favor in lots of respects.
How did things develop in the state houses?
Well, the North Carolina House and the North Carolina Senate retained their veto-proof majorities in the state legislature. So actually, the
that's amazing. It
really is, and I think that is evidence that the voters, by and large, were supportive of House Bill 2. If there was a huge backlash because of that legislation, then you would think that the Republican majorities in the House and the Senate would have taken some losses, but they did not. There were a couple of losses in the House, but they were made up by gains that Republicans took in open seats or seats that were formerly held by Democrats. And in the state Senate, the Republicans actually picked up a seat, and so they extended their veto-proof margin in that chamber. So, you know, again, evidence, when you look at the legislature maintaining their veto-proof majorities, you look at Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, who was really the champion for the privacy and safety legislation that was passed, handily winning his race in basically facing off against the same opponent that he had 4 years ago and doing incredibly well. I think, again, that speaks to the fact that there were a lot of voters who were very supportive of this legislation. And attempts to suggest that House Bill 2 had a major political impact in North Carolina really don't bear themselves out.
Well, and Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest spoke at our Values Voter Summit here in Washington.
He was great.
Back in September, did a great job. He was a plenary session speaker and strongly defended the law there as well. So we appreciate people who are not afraid to take the heat. And
you had a panel.
And I had a panel discussion where Senator Buck Newton actually spoke as well as along with the West Virginia Attorney General, Pat Morrissey. Mm-hmm. And so North Carolina was well represented at our event here in September. We haven't mentioned Buck Newton's race for Attorney General. He appears to have lost there. Any thoughts on what the dynamics were in that race?
Well, the margin in that race was about 20,000 votes that he is still trailing Josh Stein, the Democrat, who's a former member of the state Senate. And frankly, if there are that is the third closest Council of State race in North Carolina. So okay. The closest race was the state auditor position, which is separated by about 3,000 votes.
Oh, wow.
Then now we have the governor's race that's separated by currently a little over 6,000 votes. And then the attorney general's race that's separated by about 20,000 votes. So if there are significant irregularities found with respect to this election across the state, and considering that there were 4.7 million ballots cast, if there are significant irregularities, there could be enough votes to potentially switch each of these races.
Okay, so, all right. Well, John, we're about out of time. We're going to have to go to a break. But thanks for joining us, John Rustin from North Carolina Family Policy Council.
Thank you so much.
And we will be right back after this break.
Every day, more schools around the country are giving in to the transgender agenda. Boys claiming to be female are already being allowed into girls' bathrooms and locker rooms. What can parents do to stop this disturbing trend from spreading to their children's schools? Family Research Council is now offering a new resource to help. A Parent's Guide to the Transgender Movement in Education is a concise brochure that can be downloaded at frc.org/gender. To order hard copies, call 800-225-4008. You'll learn valuable tips on how to talk to your children, their teachers, school board members, neighbors, and fellow churchgoers, and the steps you can take to prevent the advancement of the transgender agenda in your school. Again, the number is 800-225-4008 to request this brochure. Your gift of just $5 will cover the cost of shipping and handling, and additional copies are available for $1. Thank you for standing strong for the family.
Are you concerned about the future? The AFA Foundation can help. End-of-year giving allows you to offset your current taxable income, providing you with valuable tax savings on this year's return. And your generous gift will help further the mission of AFA to inform, equip, and motivate people in the culture war for years to come. Through the AFA Foundation, you're supporting the work of the American Family Association by helping individuals and families leave a legacy to help stem the tide of secularism and rebuild our Christian foundations. As the end of the year approaches, carefully considering what to give and when to give it can increase the impact of your gift while still meeting your own needs as well. For example, with a cash donation, your itemized tax return may allow you to receive up to the full value of your charitable gift. Contact the AFA Foundation through Facebook, at our website, afafoundation.net, or call 800-326-4543, extension 345.
This message is provided by Liberty HealthShare.
You can control your health care with Liberty HealthShare.
Liberty HealthShare gives you freedom from health insurance.
You can finally make the right decisions for you and your family.
It's not insurance, it's medical cost sharing.
You can affordably control the cost of your medical expenses.
It's a group of individuals sharing the cost of health care. This is based on shared values.
You are not alone.
With Liberty HealthShare, you're part of something bigger, a group of people who care for and support one another.
Join the movement of people who share in medical costs and change the way you pay for your health care forever.
It's easy. Visit healthsharefamily.org right now. healthsharefamily.org. Enroll today.
Liberty HealthShare.
Together, we're changing healthcare for good. Check out healthsharefamily.org. healthsharefamily.org. Not available in Pennsylvania.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Peter Sprigg, Senior Fellow at Family Research Council.
Chris Gasek, Family Research Council Senior Fellow here.
And we're going to be talking now about the transition process for President-elect Trump and his new administration. And our first guest is going to talk about the media coverage of that transition. We're happy to welcome back on Washington Watch Dan Gaynor with the Media Research Center. Dan, welcome to Washington Watch.
It's a pleasure. Boy, this has been a crazy time for the American media. They're in crisis.
Yeah, they seem to be just they had this sort of like a kind of a nanosecond where they said they were going to like be better behaved, and then they've just gone full kind of like, you know, baying at the moon crazy.
Well, the New York Times particularly said, oh, well, we're going to make sure that we cover America more honestly. And then America laughed and everybody moved on. You know, the liberals who knew that it was a complete and outright lie went out and bought something like 60,000 new subscriptions to the New York Times because they know the Times will be the most blatantly ridiculous traditional press attacking Trump. And then conservatives, of course, responded like, of course, it's the New York Times. Does anybody think it's a legitimate news organization anymore? And so, I mean, it's like we all had a good laugh sitting around the bar. And then we went back to watching the New York Times, the Post, ABC, CBS, and NBC trying to savage each and every one of Trump's nominees.
Right. And in a sense, right, the game that's being played here, for those not familiar with it, is that you can't really focus on the nominee. Every nominee is really a proxy for Trump himself. So, you know, the way the left looks at it is a way to, destroy or wound the administration. So, I mean, it could be Sessions. It could be, it'll be the Mike Huckabee. They'll find something,
It'll be Flynn. You're right. It's working on the strategy that personnel is policy.
Right.
And so if you can destroy the personnel, it doesn't matter how you do it. It's been this way ever since Borking. If you can do that, then you win the policy game. That's their theory, at least.
Now, there's been this like intensive focus on all the Trump people, you know, and mostly Steve Bannon. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on the Democrat side? Tell us a little bit about Keith Ellison.
This is great because, you know, Steve Bannon got more than 41 minutes of coverage. And, you know, they basically, I think, they decided that he's going to ride into his office every day on a big horse in a Klan outfit or something. I mean, that's the way the media depicted him. And then Keith Ellison, who is vying for the DNC, has gotten a little over 2 minutes of coverage. So basically 20 times more for Bannon. And Keith Ellison is this far-left, wacky, liberal Muslim who thinks Israel is an apartheid state, has donors with ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, and for those not following at home, Muslim Brotherhood is one step away from Hamas. Muslim Brotherhood took over in Egypt, and Egypt rebelled to kick them out because they're so wacky and you know, radical. And then, worse than that, there's this audio tape out there, a video from him speaking where he compares at the 9/11 attack to the Reichstag fire. Now, this is history lesson time. This is the Reichstag fire was set up by the Nazis to gain power. So and when people start talking about that, the only sane and rational conclusion is that they are, much like Van Jones, 9/11 truthers. So, you know, these are all things that ordinary, sane, rational people would think are newsworthy. But because he's a far left wacko, because he's a Muslim, and because they're too busy trying to savage everybody with an R after their name, the media don't want to do anything about it.
And for a time, he was a follower of Farrakhan, right?
Oh, yeah. He's a defender. He's a defender. This is hard to find because Louis Farrakhan has been a nutball for like three decades at least. When I worked at the Washington Times back in the 80s, he was a nutball then. And to find somebody who's writing defenses of Louis Farrakhan in this day and age and make it somebody who's elected to Congress, it's astonishing to me that you could find somebody who would be willing to humiliate themselves on the national stage that much. But the media don't care.
Well, we have a local story we want to talk about. We know you live in
the area.
Well, here,
I was going to mention, as an example of the media coverage, I was checking your website at MRC today and noticed you have an article about the protests that took place at the new Trump Hotel in Washington, here in Washington, and a particular sign that was found in that was held up by someone in the crowd. You want to tell us about that?
Oh, you can hear the sense of disgust in my voice. we're told every day that, the radical right are saying awful things, doing awful things. And then if we're deplorable, this has to be worse. I'm lost for words how to describe someone who would hold up a sign saying rape Melania. But this person did, and the morning news shows didn't cover it all. The Washington Post did a story on it. The left knows when the New York Times or Washington Post do stories on things, they see these, and when they agree with them, they make them national news stories. So rape Melania trended on Twitter. It was that bad, where people were talking about it. At the very same time, you've got this British journalist columnist who talks about assassinating Trump. Assassinate Trump trends on Twitter. And yet, somehow or another, the people who are ABC, CBS, and NBC are still in their little bubble where they think that the evil, nasty people are on the right, not these nut jobs on the left.
I just want to say real quickly that I drive by there every day coming into the FRC. It's on Pennsylvania Avenue and 12th, and there's now crowds there every day of people, streaming in, maybe not crowds, but just constant stream of people taking pictures of the sign that says Trump International. You know, they clearly it's becoming a sort of a tourist spot.
In D.C. Well, I think you're absolutely right, Dan. It seems like it's always the right that's accused of hate, and yet the left gets a pass for all the hateful comments. Trump is held responsible for every crazy thing that one of his supporters does, but the left is never held accountable for the really outrageous things that their supporters do. Well, Dan Gaynor, Media Research Center, thank you for joining us on Washington Watch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Take care.
And we will be right back after this break.
Making the most of your money, here's Dan Celia.
Well, some good news as we head into the busiest travel time of the year, Thanksgiving weekend. Drivers are likely to pay the second lowest Thanksgiving gas prices in 8 years. The lowest was in 2004, according to GasBuddy and MarketWatch. Right now, it's looking like the average gasoline price is going to stand at $2.14 a gallon. There's a good chance that could go lower, but that's good news. So if you are traveling this Thanksgiving weekend, you can relax knowing that you're going to be traveling a little bit less expensive than you have in years past. So good news, very impressive, and it looks like throughout the early winter time, we are going to continue to see gas prices and energy prices decline. So good news. I know that this is the busiest time of year to travel. The bad news is if you are flying and you did not make your reservation a few months ago, you are likely to pay a little bit more this year. That's a little irritating because we all know that distilled products, including jet fuel prices, are down significantly compared to last year. But nonetheless, there are other fees and costs associated, according to the Department of Transportation, that are going to cause you to pay a little bit more to fly. So if you didn't make your plane reservations yet, maybe you want to consider driving.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. Tony is off today. I'm Peter Sprigg, Senior Fellow at Family Research Council.
And Chris Gasek, Senior Fellow as well.
And we're filling in for Tony today, talking about the Trump transition. I did want to mention that we will be taking your calls for the last 10 minutes or so of the show today, beginning at 50 minutes after the hour. If you want to call and join the conversation, make a comment, ask a question, the number is 1-866-372-7234. I'll give you the number one more time in case you're trying to grab something to write with. We'll be taking your calls at 50 minutes after the hour at 1-866-372-7234. Well, all the talk is about the President-elect Trump's transition process, and we have someone affiliated with FRC who's also affiliated with the transition directly. Our own Ken Blackwell is working with the transition team on domestic issues. So, Ken, welcome to Washington Watch.
Peter, Chris, good to be with you.
So we're hearing from the media. We just got finished talking to Dan Gaynor from Media Research Center about the media bias against President-elect Trump and his transition process. We're hearing from the media that the transition is in chaos, that there's massive infighting taking place and so forth. What's your take on what's really going on?
Well, let me just give the listeners an understanding that this transition process started back before Labor Day. And so we call that the pre-election transition process. There have been folks working on setting up the infrastructure for both technologically and personnel-wise to form a quick action transition process. And so that was already in place. And I don't think there's been a presidential campaign that has gotten that sort of head start. And let me just underscore, both the Clinton and the Trump campaigns got the same sort of funding, had the same sort of support from GSA to lay out this process. So we've had action teams. We're now prepared to send folks who are knowledgeable about the various agencies and go in and sort of look at highways of opportunities, roadblocks to progress, and then hand off to a group that will actually be the first in place in January 2021.
And we've had a few appointments already come from the president-elect. Chief of Staff will be Reince Priebus, the RNC chair. Chief Strategist Steve Bannon, who's attracted a lot of attacks. And then today, we had some cabinet-level positions announced, Senator Jeff Sessions to be Attorney General, Mike Pompeo, Congressman, to be CIA Director, and
General Mike Flynn
to be National Security Advisor. Any comments on some of these early appointments and what they tell us about President Trump, President-elect Trump?
First, President-elect Trump is a great listener. He has been in the executive position where he's had to pick leaders and managers to move his enterprises forward. So he's a good assessor of talent. And luckily for us, we have a very deep well of talented people. We have more governorships. We control more chambers of state legislatures. We have control over both houses of Congress. And many of those talented members of Congress are in areas where if they win, their replacement probably won't have any serious challenge. So he has his knowledge of the private sector, leaders and managers from across a broad spectrum of businesses and industries. So I think he has a very deep well. He has a great plan. The media have a false narrative. And that false narrative can be easily disproved when you ask them to name an incoming administration that has had this much ready to go, these many people identified this early in the process. And when you do that, you stump them.
Right. That's been one of the interesting things that some people are saying, that's behind schedule, but it really is not. I don't think people have really cited any evidence to show that it's behind schedule.
Oh, so it looks like Ken dropped.
Okay,
his phone
looks like we lost him on the phone call. Okay, well, we've only got about a minute left anyway. Just to let you know, we will be talking in the next segment with the Thomas More Society about a lawsuit by a mother whose teenage son was given gender transition treatment without her permission. And then we'll be taking your calls at 50 minutes after the hour. Let me give you that number one more time. It's 1-866-372-7234. I'll do it one more time in case you'd like to join the conversation about 50 minutes after the hour. It's 866-372-7234.
And you were just about to tell us who the Secretary of State was going to be.
I was going to ask him about Mitt Romney, but we didn't get a chance. So maybe the president-elect called him or something. But we'll be right back after this break.
Hey, our Holy Land tour in March is filling up. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of the American Family Association and American Family Radio. We only go one time a year to Israel, and that's in March, and our tour leaves the 9th and gets back on the 17th. And as I say, we don't have a whole lot of space left on this tour. So if you'd like to go with us and see the Holy Land, you need to give us a call at 800-FAMILIES, option 5, and we'll send you a brochure. 800-FAMILIES, with an S, option 5, and leave us your name and your address. We'll send you a brochure. Or go online at twholyland.com, twholyland.com. Again, we're going to Jerusalem and Bethlehem and Jericho and Nazareth and the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan River. All those places and much, much more. So join us on this very special tour of Israel in March.
The gay agenda, Islam, liberation theology, aggressive socialism. You ask yourself, how should I respond to these attacks on my Christian faith? How can I share Christ in a sinful culture? Hello, I'm John Nyhoff, president of Wesley Biblical Seminary in Jackson, Mississippi. An online Master of Arts in Apologetics from WBS will prepare you to defend and share your faith in an increasingly hostile world. Wesley Biblical Seminary, where faith and learning challenge culture. WBS.edu.
Hi, my name is Alex Njimana. I received my Operation Christmas Child shoebox after the Rwandan genocide. During a tough time in my life, it gave me hope and showed me that somebody loved me. You can share God's love by packing a shoebox of your own, or you can build one online at SamaritansPurse.org. You never know how a small gift can help change the life of a child in need. Visit SamaritansPurse.org today.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. Sweeping, epic, historic. Just a few ways in which last week's election was described. Many conservative Christians were preparing for the further degradation of the sanctity of life and loss of freedom that a Hillary Clinton administration would likely bring. We recognize that our nation was deserving of God's judgment while we prayed for His mercy. We are still a nation deserving of the wrath of God. We are still a nation in desperate need of spiritual revival. Let us pray for our president and all in authority. Let us work to bind up the wounds of our nation. And whether we face persecution or see a renewal of our nation's founding principles, may we be standard bearers of God's love and truth. This is a Decency Minute, an outreach broadcast of the American Decency Association, based in Fremont, Michigan. I'm Bill Johnson.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg, Senior Fellow at Family Research Council.
I'm Chris Gasek, Senior Fellow, Family Research Council,
and
as
we're filling in for Tony today. Our last guest today is going to talk about a story that would be really a parent's nightmare, which is to, and something that you would think the law would prevent, which is people giving medical treatment to your child, your minor child, without your consent. A Minnesota mother is suing St. Louis County, Minnesota, and several other agencies for doing just that. And here to talk with us about that is the attorney representing her, Eric Cardall, with the Thomas More Society, special counsel with the Thomas More Society, is representing Anne-Marie Calgaro. Eric, welcome to Washington Watch.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So give us the background here. You just announced 2 days ago that this woman has filed this suit. Tell us the background and what your arguments are in the lawsuit.
Right. The teenager is currently receiving transgendering medical services at a clinic here in Minneapolis, changing from boy to girl. And the mother was very frustrated because she couldn't understand how this could happen without her consent or a court order of emancipation. Emancipation means that the child was emancipated and parents can make their own decisions. And she was frustrated because she had agency after agency, the county, the school district, the medical service providers, the Minnesota Department of Motor Vehicles, just lock her out. And they locked her out from all information, any sort of involvement regarding education, medical, other decisions. And she came to us, and we started piecing together that under various statutes and state policies and agency policies, that without a court order of emancipation, the government and these medical service providers treat the child as emancipated, even though there isn't a court order.
And so is there an issue with the laws in Minnesota being unique or different from the laws in other states with respect to this issue of emancipation?
Yeah, there was a 1971 law that was passed that we were concerned about. Republicans tried to repeal it about 10 years ago, but failed because there's a Democratic Senate. But the law says that the medical service provider at the clinic can determine emancipation without a court order. And once they determine the teenager's emancipated, then that's effective medical consent. What we have is the child goes to the county and gets the eligibility determinations with respect to, getting an apartment, support for food otherwise, and then getting a qualification for, insurance, and then goes to the medical service provider, according to the medical expert we retained, who's, just an expert I hired. He said, no, that determination's made at the front desk. Basically, if the teenager can pay for the services, they get it. And so here, because Minnesota covers, the transgendering hormonal therapies received in this case, it's all done, but there's no court procedure. I mean, it's all just boom. It's like you go to the county, you get the insurance, you go to the medical provider, you get the transgendering medical procedures, and that's it. And the parent's left out in the cold with no day in court.
So you said that there was a 1971 statute that would allow a medical provider to make a judgment like this. I'm just wondering what kind of medical procedures would be covered by that statute.
Well, right. There are other statutes that cover emergency treatment and cover what's so-called reproductive rights, abortion and so forth.
Okay.
This is a statute that only deals with non-emergency, basically elective treatments. And so you have this statute that the left pushed and got enacted, and in Minnesota now we live with it. And, and in other areas of the law, we have spelled out, like in the marital dissolution, paternity, child protection, that before parental rights are terminated, due process is provided. So, we're a modern state, Minnesota, and so we recognize parental rights in these three areas. But in the area of emancipation, we don't. And then there's a specific statute that says that, the medical service provider can treat the child as if they're emancipated, but there's no corollary procedure saying, and once emancipated, the parent has a day in court to fight back. So if you remember in a typical, the child petitions for emancipation,
right?
The parent gets notice and opportunity to be heard. But when a medical service provider is saying the child's emancipated, there's no court procedure, and the statute doesn't provide a court procedure to fight back. And, of course, the common law recognizes, the child's right to petition for emancipation, but the common law doesn't recognize a parent's right to fight for de-emancipation.
Is there a general constitutional provision in Minnesota about, you can't be denied your rights or constitutional rights without due process of law?
We do, but recent cases say that there's no private cause of action under the Minnesota Constitution to do that.
Huh.
So we have to fall back on the federal due process clause, which thankfully the 14th Amendment covers this. So that's why we filed in federal court, is because everyone would agree, and my gosh, that parents need to have notice before their parental rights regarding health care decisions for the teenagers are terminated. You just need to think about that. I mean, if this happened in a marital dissolution context, that the court was deciding how the child's medical decisions were to be made without the two parents getting notice after to be heard, I mean, people would be furious.
And
right. It's so hard to convince my audience in a sense, because we're so accustomed to these rights being respected in marital dissolution, paternity, child protection.
Right.
And then you have a case where, what? How can that be?
I'm just wondering, I don't know if you know the answer to this, if this has arisen before in the context of, say, abortion or birth control in an effort to, I know the left, you know, believes that young people should have the right to have these services without parental permission. Does that play into this in some way?
No, I think that's right. What's so surprising people, and I guess, you know, some scholars are looking at this and share my surprise, is that, you know, we've had these battles over parental notice for unemancipated teenagers and stuff regarding abortions. And so those battles have been fought. But I think everyone's surprised that there's this gap in the law in Minnesota regarding, you know, non-emergency treatment of these teenagers. And how could it be that we have this big area of emancipation and haven't in Minnesota constitutionalized it? Now, I understand other states, they have similar laws that were passed back in the 70s. I haven't researched that yet. But for my client, it was absolutely devastating in the sense she didn't know what was going on. Because if you would imagine calling your school, calling the medical service providers, calling the county, and them saying, we can't talk to you. Well, why? Well, we can't talk to you about your son.
Well,
and so there wasn't any notice at all.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Eric Cardall with the Thomas More Society, and representing a Minnesota mother who has sued over gender transition services being provided to her son without her permission, a key parental rights case, and we'll be watching it.
Yeah,
closely.
This is incredibly important litigation.
Yeah, we'll be.
And we just want to say thank you to the Thomas More Society. You've done work with us on some pro-life litigation, and we're just most appreciative of the fantastic support you've given and the work that you've done. And we know that this lady will get tremendous legal representation in
right.
federal court and Minnesota courts if she needs it.
Okay. So thanks for
Thank
joining
you
us.
Much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, now we're going to be ready to take your calls. Let me give you the number right now. Again, it's 1-866-372-7234. I'll give it one more time, 1-866-372-7234. We have about 7 minutes left to talk with some of our listeners. And Daniel from Louisiana is on the line. Daniel, welcome to Washington Watch. You're on the air.
How you doing, sir?
Okay, how are you?
Fine. I love the show, and thanks for taking my call. My question is, you know, the whole issue of, like, people I hear on the radio, the political right and left, and sometimes, you know, I know that and as far as the Bible is concerned, a guy that there's right and wrong. I get a little bit confused, like, if there's, and for example, I know that abortion is wrong, and most pro-life people on the right are, you know, they're pro-life. But, is there an issue on the left that's not really morally wrong? Because I hate to say this, but it seems like everything on the left seems just wrong instead of, you know.
Well, they probably have different perspectives on, you know, like, you know, labor relations, unions. I mean, there are a lot of economic things, you know, that you can think of. I mean, they're not a Bernie Sanders kind of guy wants to tax everything, you know, that moves and can breathe.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. But I mean, you know, they're very much higher for higher taxes. And
I mean, I think historically you could probably argue that that the push for greater racial equality, the end of racial segregation, the end of the Jim Crow system in the South, that would have been considered at the time a more liberal position and so forth, but one rooted in the equality of all human beings, which I think is a Christian value. We're all mm-hmm. created in the image of God. So,
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
In the current political scene, particularly we here at Family Research Council deal with a lot of issues that revolve around family and human sexuality. And we're trying, you know, as conservatives, we're trying to conserve a traditional view consistent with the biblical view on the nature of marriage, family, and human sexuality. And the left, as we call it, seems to have completely thrown in their lot with the sexual revolution, with the idea that anything goes when it comes to sexuality or to family structure and so forth. And they've done so despite the fact that this creates devastation for the people they claim to care about, which is the poor. And the sexual revolution, the increase in, I mean, very few things contribute to poverty as much as out-of-wedlock births and divorce and so forth. The breakdown of the family is a key factor in keeping a lot of people in poverty. And yet the left, who claim to care about poverty, seems to be unwilling to unwilling to sort of face that. So as far as the issues we deal with at FRC in particular, I would say that's a crucial issue.
And it does seem like a sort of sexual realignment, a sexual anarchy in a way, or you know, is at the core of their party, of their political apparatus.
There's no compromise
right,
on
right,
that.
Right, because if you see it look like labor unions and things like that, those guys get shunted aside anytime they're in conflict with any of these sorts of these issues. But anyway, right. Better get to
yeah,
another
we'll
call.
See if we can take another call. Jose from Mississippi is calling. Jose, welcome to Washington Watch. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I know you guys have a lot of influence in Washington. Now, I'd like to somehow, if you all can get a message to Donald Trump, but I have a suggestion for the Secretary of State position, being that he's putting together his cabinet. I think that Michelle Bachmann has a lot of experience and would make a good Secretary of State. I don't know if there's someone else just as qualified better, but if somehow, you know, he would consider her, I think she's very well-versed, in, especially with ISIS and what's going on and their influence here in the United States. And then the other thing that is somehow he could, if somebody can communicate to him, I understand that the Constitution does not specify a number of Supreme Court justices. So what would keep Donald Trump from nominating 3 or 4 justices, just breaking them up and make the Supreme Court instead of just 8, you know, make it, you know, add 3 more or whatever, you know, just enough to get it on a conservative side. You know what I'm saying?
Well,
the number of justices is set by the Congress, and it has varied from time to time, but the upper bound is 9. Right now.
Right
so,
now. But yeah.
Right. You'd have to change that by statute.
Franklin Roosevelt right. tried to do that in the 1930s and was really smacked down. History has not judged him very kindly for that. The court packing, people refer to it as court packing. So I think historically probably doesn't have a good record or likelihood of succeeding. But it is an interesting point. Michelle
Bachmann.
But we
would have packed the 9 we got.
We'll pass that along to Ken Blackwell, who's in the transition.
And Michelle Bachmann is there are a lot of people in this administration who will listen to her and work with her. So she's got friends.
Yeah.
To the horror of the left.
We'll squeeze in one more call. Peter from Texas. We only have about 30 seconds. Peter, you're on the air. What's your comment or question?
I'd like to see Laura Ingraham as a press secretary, and I'd also like to see Rand Paul part of the administration in some way, because as far as I could tell, very strong on some of the social issues as far as medicinal marijuana being legalized. I see that as being a very good issue that 37 states have already have some sort of law agreeing with it. I believe Washington, there should be a national policy of having some sort of legalization, because we have too many really good people incarcerated for a plant.
Okay. Well, thanks for those tips.
I've heard that already. So
we'll take that in under advisement. Thanks for joining us today on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.